So one of the things I like to say is we imitate the oppressor. That's what we've been talking about since we've talked about how we imitate the things we don't like. So if we understand how we inadvertently perpetuate oppression in our little corner of the world, then we are better able to foster diversity, equity, and inclusion everywhere.
Welcome to the Weekly Leadership Experience, a place for leaders to get inspired, be challenged, and grow. I am your host, Rashad Oberlander. Let's get started. Today's episode of the Weekly Leadership Experience is brought to you by my 7-day Leadership Growth Challenge. It's a free challenge that I've created, and it's delivered by email over the course of 7 days. I've created 7 compelling questions to challenge various aspects of your leadership, the way you lead, and why you lead. Go to rashadoberlander.com and scroll down until you find the 7-day Leadership Challenge, or look for the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show. Hello, leaders, and welcome to the show. Today's guest is Dr. Jean Lighting, president of Leading Consciously LLC and professor emerita at the Graduate College of Social Work at the University of Houston. As a consultant, researcher, and educator, Dr. Jean focuses on leadership in multicultural and diverse organizations. Through her organization, Leading Consciously, Dr. Jean helps individuals and organizations create resilient, sustainable, multicultural, and diverse settings. Well, Dr. Jean Lighting, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I am delighted to be here, Rashad.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. And I appreciate you taking out the time. As with many of my interviews, it's kind of late in the day. So thank you for taking time out of your evening, afternoon to talk with me. Dr. Jean, I would love to chat a little bit about your life and career. Seems you've dedicated a lot to helping others achieve and do more. So I'd like you to introduce yourself a little bit more and tell us a little bit more about what has motivated you to focus your efforts on helping other people.
Well, I can't remember not ever wanting to help other people. I was an avid reader as a child, and my favorite stories were those of people helping people. Dogs rescuing puppies, fire people, rescuing people from fires, big sisters saving their little sisters from being hit by a bus. My earliest career that I conceived of was when I was 9. I wanted to have a home for what was then called crippled children, because I thought it was so sad that children in wheelchair could not play on the playground. And I read stories about children who were wheelchair bound, and I wanted to do something. So that's just been me all my life. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered the field of social work, which is what I'm in, I said, oh, that's the name of what I want to do.
It was the light bulb moment, which I think is so nice to have and realize what it is you want to do. But I guess you could say it's been in your nature to want to help people. All along.
Yes, it has.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful. And I love that you mentioned the story about when you were 9. I read that on your website, and it's a heartwarming story, you know, when, especially as, a young person wanting to help another young person, because I think in sometimes our society, we lose sight of teaching those skills, and, you know, and it's important that we all remember that.
Yeah, I drew a picture of the sliding board with the pulleys. They had pulleys they could pull up with their hands, a platform that swung around, and then it leveled down fun, and then it leveled off at the bottom so their braces wouldn't get stuck somewhere. Mm-hmm. I drew my 9-year-old self as best I could of how that whole thing would work, and then I set about trying to invent all the playground equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more as it went on from the age of 9 and you were wanting to help people, and you've kind of progressed and you've become very educated, and you've, you know, had a foundation in your name and a few other things that are really quite impressive. So I guess what else has sort of driven you throughout your career towards this point now?
Okay, just minor correction. It's an endowment, not a foundation. It doesn't give out money. It's an academic title.
I see. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the person donated, the philanthropist, Dr. Maconda Brown O'Connor, donated money to us so I could conduct my research. So what, ask your question again.
I just wanted to know a little bit more about what has sort of driven you along in your career and what has continued to, I guess, hold so strong a motivation for you.
People want to be better. People want to be better leaders. And our models for good leaders are our parents. And whether our parents were good leaders or bad leaders, we get imprinted early on from their style of leadership, their style of having authority over us. We decide that's what's right. And then we somehow or another get promoted into leadership, or we decide to become entrepreneurs or whatever. And most people receive very little training in what it means to be a leader. And what I have, you know, the divorce rate, I think, is in over 50% in this country. And the same things that drive the divorce rate are what drives the leadership horror stories you hear about. And so what I want to do is interrupt that, basically, and provide people with information and tools so they can be skillful leaders and not just emulate what they learned from who knows what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we sort of do what we've observed and been taught by absorption, I guess, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And what's our point of contrast? People grow up, and I'm sure you experience that. People grow up and say, I'll never be like my mom. I'll never be like my daddy. And then one day they look up and they're yelling at their kid or punishing their kid or whatever in exactly the same way, because that's what they've learned.
Yeah, that's so true. And I completely relate to that. And I think even, you know, I've said it, you know, I'll never be like such and such a leader or manager in my life, right? Because, you know, they did things that I didn't agree with or behaved in ways that maybe weren't appropriate. And it's like, you know, we can try to not be that way, but sometimes that's the only example you've seen.
Or it's implanted, you know, habits. We pick up habits, and habits are very contagious, and emotions are very contagious. So if we're surrounded by that, then we emulate it.
Yeah.
So we have a conscious decision not to.
Right. And I guess we're talking about the opportunity to lead more consciously, right? Which I'd love to talk more about with you on this show today. But I'd just like to draw attention to a phrase that's on your website, and I think is important in terms of the conversation that we're having. And the phrase is get unstuck, change your story, and achieve more. So I'd love to just hear a little bit of your thoughts on that in relation to what we've just been talking about. And maybe I think it sets the stage nicely for talking further today.
I am so delighted you said that. You know, you send stuff out into the universe and you don't know if anybody sees it. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Okay, so let's go get unstuck. All of us have run into situations where we're stuck. We do not know what to do next. And what's keeping us stuck is our story about ourselves, our story about the way others should be, our story about the way things should work, our story about how wrong the other guy is, our story how innocent we are. So we stay in our story. And we think the only way out is if those other folks would behave, then we could get unstuck. But the secret truly is to change our own story about how how we will choose to respond to whatever is in front of us. So I'm reminded of, as an example, and sometimes I cite with my clients, Nelson Mandela, who went to prison under the most horrendous of circumstances, was beaten, and chose to view the gods as human beings. And when he was released to become president of South Africa, how in the world, what kind of mind can be in prison all of those decades, be bowed to by the South African white guards when he was released, and then go on to be president? He had to not keep the story of himself. He had to change his story repeatedly of who he was and who the gods were. That's not to let the gods off the hook. That's not to say he was not oppressed, but he chose his story. Hmm. And as a result, he was able to achieve more. Hmm. So you and me in our corner of the world, I like to think of myself, my little corner of the world, whenever I'm stuck, I moan and suffer and complain. And I allow myself up to half a day. If I go 2 days, I'm mad at myself for staying stuck. But that I go through all of that and get all upset that the world's not treating me fairly. And then I know what to do.
That's a big decision, though, to change your story, you know, to choose to believe something else than the way you perceive your little corner of the world. That's not something that comes naturally.
No, it does not come naturally. I think of Edison, was it? You know, there's a thousand ways to do a light bulb. I read a lot of books as a child. Oh. The Wright brothers were one of them. They kept trying to fly that airplane. And they tried again and again and again, Edison again and again and again, all the slave rebellions again and again and again, they try to escape. So I read a lot of stories of people who would try again and again and again. They try it this way, they try it that way. So I grew up on stories of perseverance. Mm. And if this way doesn't work, try it a different way. And a lot of people give up. If this way doesn't work, they blame the other person. And say, the other person isn't ready, if the other person won't act right. And for me, if this way doesn't work, let me try it that way. And if that doesn't work, let me try it another way.
Mm. Yeah, so important. You know, I'm thinking of, we're talking about leadership today, but with my kids, my girls is like, they're trying something, they get frustrated, they smack the toy on the ground. It's like, well, did you try a different way? And it's like, it's a hard hurdle to get past, but an important skill to learn. So what do you suppose is the difference between, I guess, people that can persist, as you've described, you know, Edison and the Wright brothers and various other folks over the many years, of they're willing to continue trying and failing often, and people who maybe don't. What was the difference?
Okay, and I'll answer that, but there's a third person, and that's that person who keeps trying the same thing over and over and over again and doesn't change strategies. Hmm. That's the person who says, that's the parent who says, how many times do I have to tell you? Well, once that phrase comes out of your mouth, you're stuck in an old story about that doesn't work.
Right.
Right. So let's take them one at a time. The person who gives up trying is the person who didn't have you or someone like you as a parent, a model of trying another way. Your daughters are fortunate that they are learning that if this doesn't work, I should keep going and try a different strategy. That's basically what you're teaching them. And so if they grow up to be leaders in some organization, they will already have that with them, because we learn by modeling. So most people I know who are persistent, perseverant, they have learned to change strategies, or they've been in therapy, or they've been into a personal growth workshop or taken a course or something where they learn. There's a guy who calls it the inner passivity. There's a part of us that goes passive in the face of what we regard as insurmountable obstacles. We just throw up our hands. And so I was talking with one of my coaching clients, and I said, is there a part of you who's really stuck? I said, is there a part of you that just thinks you don't have what it takes? And this is a prideful person. And he said, yes. I said, well, that's who we have to defeat. This inner person who believes it. And all of us have that inner person in us. I'm not immune for that. I told you, I moan and groan when it doesn't work out. That's the inner passive part of me who says, why am I fooling with this? This is ridiculous. And so I have to consciously be aware that this is a part of me that will give up and then choose another. So that's that person. Then there's the person who tries the same thing over and over again. And this is the person who thinks they can control the universe, learn to control the universe. They might have been beaten as children. So they think, if I'm strong enough and if I'm big and bad enough, I can change what's obviously unchangeable. But I'm going to keep trying. And nobody taught me to try a new strategy.
Mm. Yeah, three very different people with very different outcomes. And I mean, a few times you mentioned, you know, the idea of conscious choice and choosing the path, I guess, that you're on, which I think I'd love to spend some time here is, you know, we talked about changing your story and leadership and ability to lead consciously. And I think that's sort of where we are right now. So, you know, you've said in some of your material, the ability to lead consciously can open your eyes.
Yes.
So, you know, let's start with a little bit of what you identify as leading consciously. What does that mean?
That means moving beyond our default habits. A lot of people, I know I had a colleague who said, I'm not going to change my style. I am who I am. So this person was defining her style by her habits. And what our mantra is, identify with your values, not with your habits. So my value is I want to be a great leader, not a good leader. My value is I want people who are working for me and with me to feel appreciated and feel it as though they can achieve. And I don't have a habit that's bigger than that value. There's nothing that I'm used to doing that's bigger than my value of what kind of world I want to create. So I'm willing to change my habits so I can be better at doing that.
So changing your default habits, I guess, would be the starting point.
Yes.
In terms of conscious leadership as a practice.
Yes. Willingness to change your default habits.
Willingness to change. Big difference. So in your experience, what are the most common, I guess, default habits that you run into? What are people maybe struggling with, generally speaking, that we can begin to shift towards the idea of conscious leadership?
Sure. I've already talked about inner passivity, the belief there's nothing I can do, it's too big, I'm not enough. They have it all wrapped up, those folks, they're in charge and I can't do anything. So we have to fight that. So that's one default habit that all of us fall into at times. The other default habit is I can thread this needle. Never mind that I don't have my glasses on. Never mind that I can't see it. I can make this person behave. I can make this person behave. I can make this person do what I want them to do. And since I'm the boss and I'm telling them, I should be able to make them to do it. And since I'm paying them, they should willingly do it because I said so. Well, that may have worked in the 1930s when we were talking about people working on machines. But today's employees don't want to be ordered and told around. And you get some millennials whose parents, helicopter parents, raised them to not suffer any pain. And they are not interested in obeying you just because you said so. And so the default habit is somehow believing I can make this person do. And if you don't do what I say, I'll fire you, where there's only so many times you can fire somebody. And they've estimated the cost of replacing employees to be the equivalent of 6 months' salary, because you have to hire somebody else. You have to fire that person for cause, depending on the organization, hire somebody, screen for somebody else, hire somebody else, train somebody else. Much easier to change your style of leadership so you can keep the person.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think I'm just reminded, like on a side note, in one of the leaders in my life was known for saying, like, if you've hired this person and they don't work out, it's more on you than it is on them because you made the decision to hire them. So how are you going to help make them successful? Exactly. Where, whatever that might be.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. And a lot of times people say, I don't have time for this. I don't have time to listen to this person. I don't have time to train. And what I always say, you have time to go home and complain about this person for 2 hours.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. And I've been there. So
Those 2 hours investment in complaining about the person could have spent in learning how to deal with the person.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Jean, I know some of the work that you work on, and maybe not all, but certainly a portion, and definitely some of the things that I was reading about you and there is working with organizations and leaders on diversity, inclusion, equality. So I'd love to touch on the fact that there's just not one, but many racially charged issues facing our society. You know, there's several in North America. Obviously, we've had very direct encounter with Black equality, and in Canada, there's also been some serious issue with the Indigenous community, yes. And you know the residential schools and things like that. So there's been a number of very large issues, and I'd like to know your perspective on how leading consciously can help us face these matters better.
Okay, so I want to add Native Americans in the U.S., in the upper Northwest, are going through hell in a handbasket right now, many, especially those on the reservations. So how can we help? What can we do? The first and most important is to become aware of how we ourselves perpetuate oppression. Today, a lot of people think, oh, all of that happened in slavery. I didn't own slaves, so I'm not a part of that. I didn't endorse segregation. That's over with. So I don't understand that. Why are we talking about these things today? There's a concept that I was just reading about, and I might do a blog post on called rankism. How people who are powerful think that they have the right to lord it over people who are less powerful in organizations. Yes, you have the authority, but you do not have the right to be abusive. And rankism, as this guy Robert Fuller defined it, is the abuse of power. So one of the things I like to say is we imitate the oppressor. That's what we've been talking about since we've talked about it, how we imitate the things we don't like. So if we understand how we inadvertently perpetuate oppression in our little corner of the world, then we are better able to foster diversity, equity, and inclusion everywhere. I think of these little pockets of people, and I know pockets of people all over the globe who are working on this. And our little bitty effort in our corner of the world may be only hitting so many people, but if enough of us are collectively doing it, we're creating a movement. So the question is literally, how are you treating the people in your life space? And if you are a leader, what complaints do people have about you? If the people of color are not complaining, ask. What do I need to know to be a better leader? What do I know about diversity and inclusion to be a better leader? How am I inadvertently doing or saying something that's oppressive? And you're not telling me because you don't want to look like a whiner, like you're pulling the race car. So ask.
That requires a degree of bravery, I think, too, that is, you know, another thing that maybe hasn't been taught, but, you know, I mean, you know, that is maybe the most simple, but possibly one of the more powerful things we can do in our leadership practice is talk to the people that we work with and find out what's going on.
Yes. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to phrase this question, but I want to be a great leader. And this is a multicultural organization, even if it only has 2 blacks in 100,000, we're still multicultural, two Native Americans, 100,000, we're still multicultural because you're here. What am I missing? And Marshall Goldsmith, who is a leadership guru, he's written a lot about leadership. He talks about forward feedback. If you want to be a really good leader, you go ask your employees, what do I need to know differently? What do I need to know to improve? And leaders think that all that feedback information is supposed to flow down. They don't realize it should also flow up.
Yeah.
You know, you think of a bowler, somebody learning how to bowl, and a coach is trying to tell them, or a friend is trying to tell them, or a kid is trying to tell them, if you stop twisting your arm that certain way, the ball won't go into the alley. And then the person says, who are you to tell me something? What do you know? I'm doing it my way because I'm me and this is my style. And all these balls keep going in the alley because they don't know how to take feedback.
Yeah. Yeah, that's important. Hey, it's like, be prepared to ask, but be prepared to take the feedback.
Be prepared to get your feelings hurt.
Yeah.
I'm real clear about that. And everyone I coach, if you want to be great, be prepared to get your feelings hurt.
Yeah. Well, I think people who are listening need to write that down. You know, step one, ask. Two, take the feedback and get your feelings hurt.
Step three, learn and grow. Trial and error. Keep going until you get it right.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, Dr. Jean, one of the things that interests me about creating inclusive environments is how we can combat our tendency to be drawn to people who are the same as us. You know,
you got that.
Like we've I guess as whether it's as humans or whatever, but you know, we've got this tendency to be like, oh, this person is like me, you know, let me give them a job, or this person is like me, let me promote them, or whatever the thing is. But how would you say we can go about addressing this?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence or research on that. One is you broaden the pool. Where do you recruit from? How can you broaden the pool? Second is mandate. In an organization, mandate. There are some organizations right now that say, you cannot promote someone unless you show me that you have a diverse pool that you're drawing from. So mandate the diverse pool. The third thing is have a diverse group of screeners. When I was at the University of Houston and we had a research center, there were two of us who were Black on it. I was the head. And when my staff were hiring people, they would bring me in to help them screen with a Black person so that I could see from my eyes what they can't see. What we know is people, when you are raised in a culture, you can recognize signs of potential in that culture that someone outside of that culture can't see. And so one of the things that happens if it's a predominantly white organization, the white hiring person can look at another white person and see signs of the potential in that person. Whereas when they're hiring a person of color, or if it's a man hiring a woman, they are missing, they don't have those subtle cues in their consciousness. And so they want it proven. Prove to me, let me see your proven background. So what happens is people of color have to hire on a proven record. Whites get hired on potential. They've shown that again and again and again. So you recognize that's what's going on. You bring in a diverse pool, you bring in a diverse group of screeners. And then the third thing is have written criteria in a checklist. Because if you go with your instincts all the time is going to go with the known, not the unknown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are some really practical and important ways that we can address, I guess, being drawn to the same similarity bias. You know, and I think it's definitely something that needs to be addressed because it's too easy to fall into it. And if it's left unchecked, it sort of just grows on its own, right?
Yeah, and I'm really kind of surprised that you asked that. A lot of people don't know that, don't even think about similarity bias and the impact it has on the organization.
Yeah, I mean, well, and it's. I think if most people who are listening were to look at their careers or lives and think about it for long enough. And maybe not even that long, but I think that we could probably each think of times, both in a professional setting and in personal settings, where you can see that it's at play. Because, you know, you grow up in a town and you go to the same school and you leave school and you all marry each other. And then you all have kids and they all go to the same school and they all marry each other. You know, it kind of grows. And when you look at this, it's... they're all the same as one another, right? Exactly. And in a business setting, like you know, you're drawn to many times, you know, someone who's of the same leadership style, the same this and the same that, and your colleagues are all in that same kind of setting, right? And so I think that those examples exist if we want to see them. And I think in the theme of how we've been talking, the changes in leading consciously is seeing it and making a choice to do something different.
Right. And having something called organizational fit as a criteria. Will this person fit in? Well, if all of y'all went to the same kind of school and the same age group and same background, you're not talking about an organizational cultural fit. You're talking about a group of people type, subculture fit.
Mm. Yeah, which is very different.
Which is very different.
Certainly. Well, let's talk a little bit more about, I guess, confronting lack of diversity. You know, you wrote a blog post, really good blog post, about Amy Porterfield, who's an online content creator and course developer, email list, and all this kind of stuff. You know, big audience. She's a fairly well-known individual. And she had to kind of come face-to-face with lack of diversity and in her own organization, as well as sort of some personal revelations about, you know, some of the, I don't know, racist tendencies, I suppose, in her own life. And I suppose the article I found quite enlightening being demonstrating her own conscious leadership and her choices she made to change what was going on. So you know, talk a little bit about that and what, in the example of Amy Porterfield, we can learn that some of the most important things to remember when facing lack of diversity and racism and oppression in our own lives and workplaces.
Sure. So let me first say that I would not and I would never describe what she was experiencing as racist tendencies. She was experiencing similarity bias. She was experiencing lack of awareness of similarity bias. She didn't realize that she was living in a bubble until she got called out publicly online in front of her 25,000 followers, which was a harrowing experience. And we just talked about leading consciously and how do you become aware, being called out in front of 20 and getting your feelings hurt. Getting called out in front of 25,000 followers online has to be a harrowing experience. And I was fascinated with how she approached it. You and I just talked about try out a different strategy. When she got called out, she could have retreated in passivity. She could have said, I'm doing the best I can, because we talked about doing the same thing over and over again. I'm doing the best I can. I don't see any people of color around me, so there's nothing I can do. But she didn't. She chose to lead consciously. She reached out. She got an expert. She asked her followers for their opinion. She swallowed it. She took it. And then she proceeded to make changes in her organization. And one of the things I'm thinking about is trying to, at some point, bringing her back to say, okay, tell me now, 1 year, 2 years later, what have you learned? I tremendously admired her willingness to not only do what she did, but to go public with it. And so for those of us who are sitting at home saying, but I don't want to be embarrassed, you read the blog post about what Amy Porterfield had to go through. Mm-hmm. And you cannot tell me, I should put it more positively, I am convinced that she modeled for thousands of people another way of how to handle public embarrassment, how to handle diversity and inclusion, how to handle leading consciously, how to grow up in front of people. Grow in your leadership skills in front of people. Nothing, I've been publicly embarrassed. I've been called all kinds of names, especially early in my career, and insulted publicly, laid out by community groups and all of that. But I have not endured the kind of public online criticism that she did.
And there's a lot to learn from her experience. But if you had to identify two or three of the most important things in a circumstance like that, or in looking at our own lives, what would you say that we should do?
The first is the willingness to be wrong. This is another way of the will. This is a variation of the willingness to take feedback. This society raises knowers. We got to know. I have a friend right now. If I say, oh, I learned such and such, she'll say, oh, I knew that already. So this society, you know, we grew up and we go to school and the teacher said, who knows the answer? And if you got to get the right answer, because you get the wrong answer, everybody points your fingers at, ooh, and everybody snickers, and then we suffer acute embarrassment. We have not learned how to learn. So willingness to be wrong and willingness to learn. It's just ironic to me. We all want to grow and learn, right? But before you can grow and learn, you got to first recognize you were wrong. Whatever it was you were thinking that leads you to grow, you were had a wrong assumption. So we have to be willing to be wrong. So that's key. Amy Porterfield was willing to be wrong. Second, we've already talked about, is the willingness to listen to others. She talked about her one moment of defensiveness, which I thought was so cool, because she, in my blog post, I should explain. I first did a blog. I discovered this whole thing unfolding in front of my eyes. Then I wrote for permission to write a blog post about it and then subsequently interview her. So there's two on Amy Porterfield, the blog post and then the interview. In my blog post, I mentioned that she had posted about she had done what wrong thing she'd done and how dismayed I had been. And so in the interview, she said, well, I didn't actually do that. I actually did this other thing, which isn't quite as bad. And I said, Amy, we all, when we're wrong, we say, I didn't actually take the cookie at the cookie jar. I actually just moved the cookie jar and took one cookie and put it on the table, getting ready to eat it. But I didn't actually, you're still wrong. You took the cookie out the cookie jar. So you're wrong. So we get all technical when people try to tell us where we're wrong. They get one little piece of fact wrong and we say, no, I didn't do that. So being willing to be wrong is to listen to the heart of what they're saying and not every bitty little detail, looking for the one detail where that's not true. I didn't do that. Listen to the idea of what they're trying to tell you. Help them get it out, because most times people are scared to death to tell you. Help them get it out and own it. Mm-hmm. And then you have the capacity to make a change. One of my relatives used to, every time I said something or gave her any kind of little piece of feedback, she says, you must think I'm a horrible person. No, I think you did this one small thing on this one day at 10 a.m. in a way that wasn't cool. I'm not talking about the totality of you as a human being. I'm talking about one incident on one day at one period, one time. So that's what I'm asking you to own. You as a human being are worthwhile and good, or else I wouldn't be wasting my time talking to you. If I thought you were the derelict of the earth, I wouldn't waste my time talking to you. I'm talking about one thing. So we have to be willing to own, on this day, with this one thing, it wasn't so cool.
Yeah, the steps, or it's not steps, but the formula, maybe we could call it, that you're describing. It's simple, but not easy.
You got it.
And it requires that choice, that bravery, you know, and the willingness to lead consciously that we've been talking about in this conversation today. And I think that we overcomplicate it. We make it a lot more, you know, like all these steps and all these self-help things and all these, I don't know, complicated ideas, you know, but I thank you for simplifying that. And making it, I guess, digestible, because it really is a lot simpler, I think, than we think. And we have to make a choice to take the difficult path It's a simple one, but it's not an easy one.
Well, I thank you for allowing me to be here and to talk about this. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about it. I want us to have a world. We all want a certain kind of world. You asked me that. We all want the world to be a better place. And we don't know how our reluctance to learn is helping to keep the world intact that we don't want to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't think we can have this kind of a conversation too many times. I think that this kind of conversation will continue to be necessary and will continue to be important for people to listen and to learn, and to have open hearts and minds. So thank you for sharing your wisdom and experience today. I would love for you to tell us what one thing is you know about life or leadership that you wish everybody knew.
You can do more than you think possible. You can be more than you think possible.
There's a lot of people that need to hear that. I need to hear that sometimes too. I'm going to play that sound clip a couple more times.
Thank you.
And what is one thing, what are the three words you want used to describe your life?
Continuously learning. That's two words.
Perfect. Well, that's awesome. Dr. Jean, thank you so much again for being on the show.
Can I talk about my program?
You may. And I was just going to say, what would you like to tell us about? People can connect with you, learn more about what's going on.
Okay. So I offer right now, we offer Pathfinders Leadership for Racial and Social Justice. It's more focused on leadership than racial. Well, it's a mix. And it's at our website at leadingconsciously.com. It's a membership program. And it's this is the low time investment, low cost program. We're about to offer the skill-based program based on our Leading Consciously skills sometime, hopefully in the early spring. So that's coming out. But in any case, please subscribe to the blog and look at Pathfinders and see if that program interests you at all. And again, leading consciously. People don't know how to spell consciously. So consciously.com. And I'm sure it'll be there in the whatever. So leadingconsciously.com.
Oh, that's perfect. Well, Dr. Jean, thank you so much. I will make sure that the link to your website and LinkedIn and also that blog for Amy Porterfield that you wrote, make sure to have all those in the show notes. This has been a beautiful and wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for sharing and for being with me today.
Well, thank you very much. I've tremendously enjoyed it, and I have been totally impressed with the depth of your questions and your preparedness. You actually read.
Well, thank you. I try to come to the conversations with, you know, some intelligence and some preparedness. So thank you.
Well, you did.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Bye.
If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, would you head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe, leave me a rating, leave me a review, and share this with a friend. It spreads the word and helps the podcast grow. You can also find me on social media at R.E. Oberlander. Until next time, stay awesome.